I am the architect. I created the Matrix.
Shall we play a game?
This is Bob Sherwood. That's it, Bob Sherwood from webtalkwithbob@gmail.com. Coming to you from the heartland of America. And I know that my podcasts have historically been oriented toward politics, but frankly, there's not much politics going on right now. There's arguments among the TV shows. So I have a treat for you today. I hope you'll enjoy it. If you do, please let me know and I will continue the story. Yes, the story. I don't think there's anything more interesting or fascinating than true stories. I noticed Clint Eastwood always gets the great true stories to make movies about. Some people's lives are just too fascinating and too interesting that they couldn't be made up. They couldn't be fantasy. So here's a fella who literally rose from nothing to a net worth of over $300 million. That's this story that I'm going to introduce you to. He had all of the toys you can imagine. Yes, he had the jet, the helicopter, the bulls, the horses, the multiple houses, the limousines. And yes, I did know him. He was a wonderful and generous person. I'll leave you to decide whether or not he was gullible and whether or not he is now happy because he lost his entire fortune. The story is about how he built it up and how he lost it and whether or not he's happy now. And I know the story's true because I have a picture, a photograph of my oldest boy and my father-in-law getting out of this person's helicopter on the first tee at one of the most famous golf courses in Texas. Yes, the golf course had just started, and the person that this story is about loaded up my father-in-law and my oldest son, with a golf bag, took him out to the golf course and landed right near the first tee. It is an incredible photograph, but an example of generosity and how wonderful stories can be. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about Mickey's story. And I'm going to start with essentially the opening, page one of the book that we wrote together about his life. Yes, in fact, when I put the book together, not only did he have all the toys, but he had five or six wives. I interviewed all of them. It was, in and of itself, a fascinating story. As I was about to make my entrance to this life, Hitler made plans to invade Poland. To get you in perspective, it was June 10th, 1939. June 10th, 1939. Hitler was making plans to invade Poland. Lud Gehrig, a baseball player, was retiring from the Yankees. Mickey Mouse starred in a cartoon at the 1939 World's Fair. Of course, Walt Disney went on with Mickey Mouse to become famous. Very shortly after June 10th, 1939, Gone with the Wind was introduced and The Wizard of Oz, two movies that still are in the cinema historical list, and movies that even today, almost 70 years later, people are familiar with. But a key part of Mickey's story was also just starting at that point. The savings and loan industry was a whisper at that point in congressional ears. But several states, including Minnesota, passed legislation that set the stage for the future growth of savings and loans and the eventual collision with Mickey's career. As a sideline in my story, Ross Perot, founder of EDS, entered the world 9 years ahead of me. He always did have a head start. When I was born, John Connolly had just turned 22. His fateful intersection as a passenger in John F. Kennedy's car on the day of the president's assassination was many years in the future. That's right, John Connolly was 22 when I was born, would eventually be in the same car with John Kennedy. Connolly, by the way, lived only a few miles down the road from me, and he became a business partner of mine, as well as an associate of a man named Joe Marchman. We'll talk about Joe later. But Connolly and Marchman and my path would cross many times between the time that I was born in 1939 and when Connolly became governor of Texas in 1963. I should tell you that Connolly used to come into my office through the back door so he wouldn't raise any suspicion as to what real estate he might be involved in. His limo would pull up in the back of my office. He would get out, come through my back door, and we would discuss business dealings in Texas. I hobnobbed with the top. I flew in jets with the Dallas Cowboy football players and spent $500,000 at auctions on Rolex watches and other expensive things. But that came later. Now, I was being born. And as I will explain later, these characters, the Connollys, the Perots, the Kennedys, the Marchmans, all had an impact on my life. I, of course, on June 10th, 1939, have none of this because I was screaming my head off. My butt was being slapped and my cord was being cut. But my entrance into life was like so many others in 1939. Of course, it was unique for me and my parents. For me, it was the beginning. And it was the beginning of an incredible story that I call Riding the Bull. No, it's not about rodeos. It's about riding the bull, a big beast of burden that I got on and couldn't get off. I was sucked in by the bull, the materials coming from the bull's nostrils as it stomped its feet on the ground and tried to shake me off. And I held on for dear life. And you may say, if you listen to the whole story, the bull eventually got me. But I don't think so. I think I'm still on that bull. I'm still riding that bull. That's part of my story. Within a few months, by the way, my parents moved 100 miles south to Waco, Texas, where my dad opened an office for an automobile finance company. My parents lived a good life. They had a beautiful house. We took vacations. We were members of a classy country club. We spent lots of time at the club. My dad was a big influence on me. I don't think he was a rich person in retrospect, but he was rich as far as I was concerned. He had a healthy expense account, and we used it regularly for entertainment. We never took many trips. We did go to Kansas City very often, so a lot of my background was spent in Texas and Kansas City. The country club, a big, beautiful club where wealthy people hung out, was a vital part of my childhood. I played golf, became an excellent swimmer, could order all the food I wanted at the club, and I took my friends. They were always welcome. So I grew up in a pretty affluent type of activity. Now, I had a grandfather who was also important to me. He was a man's man. He hunted, he fished. He knew how to do all of those things. Put the bullets in the gun, clean the gun, make the bullets, aim the gun, kill something, clean it and eat it. He taught me to hunt, and he taught me to fish. I mean, fishing is not all that easy. You have to know what line to use, what lures to use, how far to cast, how deep to fish. It's pretty complicated. But people like my grandpa, my pop, as I called him, and everybody else, by the way, called him too, knew how to do all of those things. And he taught me. Yes, I went to high school, nothing special going on. My brother and I were in the same grade, although he was 3 years older. That should tell you something about what was going on in my life. Life began for me in those early years in a pretty common way. Nothing special. Except I opted not to go to college. I don't remember why, except that I got sidetracked. Yes, at a very young age, I heard that you could make a wheelbarrow full of money in Alaska. And then maybe this will reveal something about my early motivation. So what did I do? I got one of my friends, Mike McMillan, another risk taker like me, and we headed to Alaska. Now, the big wage at those days was a couple dollars an hour, but in Alaska, you could make $10 an hour. It was an obscene amount of money, and I was only 16 years old. I took money out of the bank, borrowed $200 from my dad, and I was off. It was a 5,000-mile journey, 2,500 miles on gravel and mountain roads, along the route which is now known as the Alaska Highway. I don't remember too much about that trip, except we were in a black 1954 Buick sports model, four slick tires. We pulled a utility trailer with all of our stuff. We slept in the back of the car because we did not want to waste money on hotel trips. We stopped in Denver for a while and had a few Coors beer, but moved on. We took turns driving. It wasn't easy. We had to carry gas cans. That's right. We had to carry gas cans because it was more than a tank between stations. We used the bathroom in the woods and the highest black mosquitoes I've ever seen always swarmed over our private parts. It was awful. We blew out 6 tires. We saw a beautiful wilderness, but I could only think of the punishment I was going to get every time I had to pee by those big black mosquitoes. Our trouble started when we finally arrived in Anchorage. As you can imagine, we had problems. The person, the boss, who I was going to work for, could not get his construction bond because he had gone bankrupt. So we stayed there until the money ran out. No, we tried looking for more jobs, couldn't find any, and eventually we were flat broke. I was 16 and broke in Alaska. I begged people for a job. And they said, we can't hire you because you are itinerant. I always thought they meant illiterate, but no, they meant itinerant. And that was a lesson I learned about looking for a job. And that's only part of the story. Before I left for Anchorage, my girlfriend broke my heart. She broke up with me. She surprised me. She drove a new convertible, was beautiful, and madly in love with me, I thought. And suddenly, she was in Los Angeles and breaking up with me. I don't think I ever figured out how that happened. And maybe that's another indication. I don't think I was able to read women well. I always thought they were in love with me, but maybe they weren't. So what happened? How did I get back to Texas from Alaska? What do you think? What do we all do when we're 16 and we can't get home? We call Dad. I ask him to send me a $59 plane ticket so I could get home. And I made it home. When I got back to Texas, I got jobs with my dad making $10 a day. I think the way my dad handled his business and our family had an enormous influence on me. You see, my dad wasn't rich, but everyone respected my dad. Yes, my dad. Everybody respected my dad. And I think I struggled all my life to get the same kind of respect that my dad had. That's all for now. If you want to hear more about the story, send me an email. Let me know. I'll even tell you later what each of his wives said about him. But this is not a true confession story where we're going to reveal deep dark secrets of personal relationships. It's a story about a real man, a real person who lived a genuinely wonderful life, employed hundreds of people, had literally dozens and dozens of friends, and would do anything for someone else, as he did for me and my family years ago. But it's not a sad story. He lived a great life. He rode the bull. For many of us, we go through life afraid to get on the bull and write it. We prefer to sit in the stands and watch other people with courage get on the bowl, even if they get thrown off after 4 or 5 seconds. And we say to our neighbor sitting next to us in the stands, "Wow, that must have hurt. I wouldn't do that. You have to be crazy to get on that bowl." And yet secretly and truly, we admire the bull riders. We see their courage. We want to be like them. But most of us will never be like them. We'll never have an opportunity to ride that bull. But Mickey did. And if you want to hear his story in more detail, his story about how he rode the bull, not just once, but time and time again. And did the bull throw him each time? Yes, it did. But did he get back up and get on that bull? Yes, he did. And that's the true story of American entrepreneurship. People that aren't afraid to get on that bull, suffer the pain of getting thrown off, and get right back up and ride that bull again. And for me, by the way, that is a Republican notion. Republicans are not afraid to ride that bull. We're not afraid to reach out. We have that level of courage. And certainly, people that live in the heartland of America. That's right, the Midwest. We're not afraid to get on that bull. And that's what Mickey did. So if you want to hear more about riding the bull, Mickey's story, send me an email or let me know. I'll tell you more of the exciting parts of his life. I'm sure when Mickey was in Alaska, he was using the outside bathroom, as he said, he never ever realized that 40 years later, as he looked down at his arm, 40 years later, there'd be a beautiful $50,000 Rolex watch sitting on that wrist. Diamonds on his finger worth hundreds of thousands of dollars. That's what life does. We just don't know, do we? And then we get on that bull and things happen. That's all for today. Robert Sherwood, Heartland of America, signing off. Let me know if you like this. And occasionally I'll come back to this story on this podcast. Have a good day. See you later. I brought to you courtesy of